You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
The CIA's actions a decade ago are a stain on our value and on our history.
A landmark report revealing the use of torture by the CIA has been released by the US Senate after a four-year investigation. John Everard and Samira Shackle will discuss this and the other big news stories of the day. Also coming up, we meet the director of one of the most talked about new films, Eastern Boys.
Tu peux quel jour dans la semaine? Lundi?
Yes, lundi. Comment on dit en français? Trust.
Confiance.
Toi, t'as pas confiance en moi.
We'll also be reviewing some of the best new Brazilian music and we'll meet one of the neighbours of our new Tokyo Bureau. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So much to pack in over the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news from around the world.
A US Senate report has highlighted what it's called brutal interrogation of terror suspects using techniques widely believed to be torture. The CIA is accused of misleading the American people about what it was doing and whether it worked. Techniques included waterboarding, humiliation, and sleep deprivation. The agency has insisted the harsh interrogations did help to save lives. But Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says there's little evidence to support that.
Even if one were to set aside all of the moral arguments, our review was a meticulous and detailed examination of records. It finds that coercive interrogation techniques did not produce the vital, otherwise unavailable intelligence the CIA has claimed.
President Obama says some of the actions authorized after the September 11th attacks were contrary to U.S. values, and Republican Senator John McCain says they were a stain on America's national honor.
I know from personal experience that the abuse of prisoners will produce more bad than good intelligence. I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it. I know they will say whatever they think their torturers want them to say if they believe it will stop their suffering.
Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, has sacked his deputy, accusing her of plotting to depose and even kill him. Joyce Mujuru is one of eight ministers fired by the country's longtime ruler. She denies plotting against the 90-year-old president. His wife, Grace, had led a campaign against her for some time and is widely expected to be named as her husband's likely successor. The last French hostage held by Islamist militants has been released after 3 years. The French president, François Hollande, says Serge Lazarevich is in relatively good health despite being held in harsh conditions. He was seized in 2011 by an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, which killed another French hostage last year. Ukraine's government says both sides are largely observing a ceasefire in the east of the country. President Petro Poroshenko had called for a day of silence ahead of planned talks between the government and pro-Russian separatists. Russia, meanwhile, has resumed gas supplies to Ukraine after months of negotiations. Mr. Poroshenko says both sides are desperate to end the violence and start moving forward.
Everybody is tired already from the war. This is not only just the efforts of Ukrainian president. This is not only peaceful efforts of Ukrainian people and Ukrainian states. This is also the position which, from their side, also people tired from the war.
A Spanish judge has ordered the online taxi booking service Uber to halt operations in the country. The court ruled that the firm's drivers are unfair competition with licensed taxi services. The ban has been imposed the day after officials in the Indian state of Delhi barred Uber after one of its drivers was accused of raping a passenger. The human rights group Amnesty International has accused Israel of war crimes during the summer's conflict in Gaza. It says the destruction of four high-rise buildings was effectively a form of collective punishment. Israel warned residents the strikes were on the way and no one was killed. But Amnesty says hundreds of people with no connection to Hamas lost homes and businesses. Israel says Amnesty's report has made a series of unfounded allegations. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. The time is 18.06 in London, 13.06 in Washington, D.C. My guests today are John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, and Samira Shackle from The New Humanist. We can never let the world know what I've done to you. That's just one of the more striking sentences in the Senate report into torture used by the CIA during the so-called War on Terror. The debate on the Senate floor is still ongoing, but it's already clear that much of what the Bush administration struggled to keep secret is now out in the open. A little earlier, we heard from Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, and he discussed what he expected to find in the report.
I think there's going to be a blowback in the UK, particularly, and with some of the closer allied governments. I think there already have been tremendous rows in Italy about this, about the involvement of the Italian military secret services. And I think that, for instance, I will pluck a name, Foreign Secretary at the time of much of this, Jack Straw, a lawyer, must be asked to speak to this. There is a UN convention on torture, too. This has clearly been breached. Let me say, allegedly, on the basis of everything that I know, that you know, and that has been in the record, and not denied. This is closing off not yet another area of judicial procedure. Nobody is squeaky clean. I think there's a lot of what the UK authorities did in Northern Ireland in Operation Banner from 1969 for 30 plus years could be questionable under these circumstances. And this is why it's a big moment. There will be initial reaction. And I think there will be some very serious thinking and writing about it.
That was Robert Fox giving us his reaction a little bit earlier. John Everard, we're already seeing reaction from around the world to what's been released here by the Senate. We'll come on to that reaction in a moment. But first of all, what do you feel, you know, obviously this report only came out within the last hour, but what do you feel that we know now that we perhaps didn't know before?
I don't think it's so much what we know now that we didn't know before. I mean, the subjects of this report have been discussed extensively for a long time. It's more that we now have actually on official Senate paper, so confirming officially things that we knew before. The maltreatment, the complex system of rendition, and in particular, the real question marks over whether any of this actually provided any intelligence that was worthwhile.
It's quite interesting, Samira, that amongst those supporting the fact that this report has come out it's not a straight Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other. John McCain, Senator John McCain, has come out and said it's good that this is out here, and has repeated his view that, you know, quite aside from the moral rights and wrongs of torture, it doesn't actually help. Torture leads to bad intelligence, he's just said.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if it's I think the sort of idea of bipartisanship in America has been so distant for so long that that's quite amazing. But yeah, I think that that's perhaps one of the most striking points in the report. As John said, it's been quite heavily trailed for quite a long time, and we it's now sort of officially noted that torture is both has been sort of more brutal and more wide ranging, more widely used than before. But I think that point has particular potential to unite left and right on this issue, which is the point that it actually isn't effective. So putting aside the moral issue, it seems that it's sort of clear evidence that it doesn't work. And that's something that campaigners have said for years, that it provides faulty intelligence. But it seems also that the CIA has actually been, literally lying about it in order to make it seem like it has been more effective.
I'm not so sure that it unites left and right. We'll have to see about that.
Yeah, I think that it had the potential to.
Okay, well, let's see. I mean, I think this is specifically John McCain, who, of course, knows all about being held and being maltreated for long periods.
I want to look at this issue of legality, because the US administration has been very clear about saying, previously under President George W. Bush, that this was legal, and that they had all the documents they needed to prove that it was legal. And Barack Obama, in his statement, has been very careful about using the word torture. And even Dianne Feinstein has referred to their torture as morally misguided. But on the legal question, John, essentially, let's put it bluntly, are the people that did this going to get away with it?
I have absolutely no idea. I mean, this is a legal minefield over which highly skilled and highly paid lawyers have pored for a long time and will continue to work for a long time more. I don't know what the answer is going to be.
Because, Samir, that is the issue, isn't it? That it's all very well, you know, politicians get up and saying this is a stain on America's standing across the world. This was morally wrong. But if actually the people that were responsible for this program, if the groundswell of opinion is that this was wrong and shouldn't have happened, and yet they don't even have to stand up and accept responsibility for it, let alone face any consequences, that's not going to be viewed elsewhere around the world with much pleasure, is it?
No, I don't think it will, but I'd be very surprised if there were the type of legal redressing the balance or convictions and so on that you seem to be talking about. Because I think it would be, I mean, if you consider the sort of quite how high up the chain of command this went, it's essentially was something that was authorised by George Bush's administration that goes right up to the very, very top of his administration, Dick Cheney, George Bush. So I think the implications from that angle alone of seeking prosecution and so on this would be so wide-ranging that I don't imagine that there is any sort of prosecutors in the US who would go for it. I think the other issue is that as we've seen throughout the last sort of what is it now 13 years of the so-called war on terror, that I don't think that it's been this sort of idea that that the ends justify the means, that we have to sacrifice some of our rights in order to guarantee safety, and that's something which has been quite broadly accepted by the public, with some exceptions. And this era hasn't really been characterised by a sort of consistent and fair acceptance of the rule of international law. I think there's been this idea of the exception becoming the rule, and I don't think that anyone will sort of, given the fact that we've had so many trials which have been couched in secrecy for the sake of national security, I'd be very surprised if that changed at this point.
John Everard, looking at the international reaction, as Robert Fox was saying earlier, there will be potential consequences in many countries and questions that need to be asked. In the UK, for instance, we've had there are questions over how much the UK knew, particularly over issues over what was known as extraordinary rendition or kidnapping, essentially. What sort of questions do you think are going to be asked in Whitehall tonight?
Not so much in Whitehall, I think, as in Parliament. I think in Whitehall, people broadly know the answers anyway. But I think a lot of people in Parliament are going to want to know, well, just as you said, how far the UK was involved in these programmes, how much the UK knew about what was going on, and how far the UK was involved in the actual application of what I see we now call harsh interrogation techniques, as opposed to simply handing people over for others to do the dirty work for them.
And Samira, more broadly, this in some ways, does it make it easier for America and the West generally to try to say they have a moral purpose and a moral compass, because they can say, look, when things like this happen, we investigate it, we make public what's happened, and we deal with the consequences? Or do you think that actually a lot of the reaction in the Middle East and beyond is going to be, well, you're just as bad as our leaders?
I think probably both are true. I think that a lot of the aim within the US in making this public and carrying out this investigation is probably to repair that international standing, which has been so damaged. And, you know, it's something that Barack Obama's consistently tried to distance himself from this era, from so-called enhanced interrogation and so on. I don't know how effective that will be. As you say, I think in the Middle East, in the areas where there's already so much anti-Americanism, I think this will, you know, with some justification, I think this will just provide sort of evidence of what people already expect, already suspected.
Okay, let's move on now to events in eastern Ukraine. There has been a sort of pause in fighting in a new attempt to revive a largely ignored ceasefire deal. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has called for a day of silence to make that much violated ceasefire deal stick. John Everard, it's difficult to make it stick. It's been difficult for since the moment it was signed. Do you see much hope that it's going to stick this time around?
Well, I have to say that this morning when the day of silence started, I was just a little bit sceptical. I thought that this would go the same way as previous attempts. Remember, this is the fourth day of silence we've had. The first three all collapsed. But now that darkness has really fallen on Ukraine, it looks as if, against all expectations, it did work, that both sides have, by and large, respected this deal. Moreover, it looks as if, although talks scheduled in Minsk today didn't happen, that the two sides will meet in Minsk later this week, perhaps Friday. I don't think we want to get the champagne off ice just yet, but this does look like modest progress.
Samira, is part of that progress down to the fact that, you know, Kiev has, you know, in recent weeks essentially accepted that they're not getting this territory back and they have to deal with this in a way that loses as few lives as possible?
It could be, I guess. I mean, I think there's a sort of sense on both sides that it's, I'm talking, you know, in terms of the Kiev government and the separatists, that that something has to happen. I mean, this has been going on for 8 months. It's been thousands of lives lost, more than 4,000. And it's quite an obvious point, but winter's approaching. And that also, I think, really highlights that sort of really compounds the desperation in these parts. I mean, lots of these areas of Ukraine where the fighting is at its most intense are, you know, really going to suffer through the winter. So I think that perhaps adds a sense of urgency. It would be good to see this ceasefire hold. But as John said, you know, there have been numerous ceasefires since the last one was declared in September. 1,000 people have died. So we'll see.
And also, John, I mean, is there also a sense that for Vladimir Putin, with the Russian economy tanking by the day, I mean, every time you look at see how much the ruble's worth, it's changed within hours, that he probably feels that there's not much he really wants to invest in terms of actual money in eastern Ukraine right now?
I think that is true. And I think it's probably more than that. I think it's not just he doesn't want to put more in. I suspect that his advisors are telling him he needs to ratchet down his commitment to eastern Ukraine. This is costing Russia a lot of money. You've got large numbers of Russian servicemen, however hard the Russians deny it, out in the field, so out of barracks, with their equipment. Just the maintenance of some of this kit costs hundreds of thousands of pounds, you know, per unit, and Russia simply cannot afford this. Coming back to the point you raised with Samira just a minute ago, whether this progress is possible because Ukraine has accepted that it's now lost these territories. I think the jury's out on that. The Minsk agreement talks about special status for the Donetsk and Luhansk areas. And what exactly special status is going to mean in practice is still to play for. We'll have to see.
Okay, one final thing, a bit of good news, perhaps. The World Health Organization says that global efforts have halved the number of people dying from malaria. It says over the past 13 years, millions of deaths have been averted thanks to life-saving interventions. Is this, Samira, a victory for joined-up government, between different governments, or just for lots of money being thrown at the problem?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I think it's partly lots of money being thrown at the problem in, as you say, in things like, you know, it's really simple things that reduce malaria, like having access to bed nets that keep mosquitoes out, because most malaria-carrying mosquitoes bite at night. So I think the money is obviously hugely important, but I think it's also a case of a sort of just an effective international drive to counter this problem and a willingness to counter it. I mean, there's obviously the fight's not over yet. There's all these problems, the potential drug resistance, insecticide resistant strands of malaria. But I think it's definitely something to be celebrated, the progress that's been made.
Yeah.
John, when you look at what's happened with the fight against malaria, are there lessons that can be learned for treating for tackling other diseases, or is it partly because, as Samira says, it is actually quite simple to prevent a certain number of malaria infections because it is something as simple as having a bed net with no holes in that tucks you up nicely at night?
Well, yes, I think the key thing about malaria is it's mosquito-borne. And as Samira quite rightly said, the availability of mosquito nets with a bit of insecticide has been one of the big changes. The World Health Organization has said that whereas at the beginning of the century, only about 4% of people in affected areas had access to these nets, now it's over 50%. That's a huge difference. And interestingly, it's not because huge amounts of money have been thrown at the problem. Most of the countries concerned can manufacture mosquito nets. I mean, they're not actually, this isn't high tech. You just need to, essentially it's a form of textile, and they can do that. But the impact on mortality rates is huge. But even so, as the WHO says at the end of its report, there's still a lot to be done. Last year, 600,000 people died of malaria, of which 3/4 were children under 5. I mean, when you compare that with, for example, the deaths in the Ukraine conflict we were talking about just a minute ago, it is a huge number. It's one of the It's an elephant in the international room, and it's something that could actually be brought much more firmly under control than it is. Just a statistic to chew on, that since this century so far, 4.3 million people have died of malaria. That is almost exactly 1,000 times more people than have died so far in Ukraine.
And yet, Samira, the fact that that number is coming down suggests that this is one of those rare health crises in Africa where the rest of the world has been interested enough and organised enough to actually make a difference.
I hope so. I mean, there are sort of worrying signs, for instance, in the West African countries most affected by Ebola, where resources are being so much diverted towards treating the Ebola epidemic that treatment and prevention for preventable diseases like malaria is reducing. I think it does have the capacity to be something that's a global health success story. There's still quite a long way to go. I think there's also lots of interesting scientific things in development. I was reading a few weeks ago about genetic modification of mosquitoes on the strands which carry malaria to sort of reduce the female progeny, because those are the ones that can transmit malaria, and sort of bringing extinction of those strands of mosquitoes. So there's all sorts of things happening. And this is something, global health problems on certain diseases that we've had success on in the past, for instance, the polio epidemic having been stamped out in all but 3 countries.
Samira Shackle and John Everard, thank you both for now. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
The Cafe Pacific experience is one of ease and exploration, introducing a contemporary Asian experience to international travel. By placing service at its core, Cafe Pacific evolves with its passengers, creating a home away from home in its lounges and aircraft. Having built its name on service and quality, Cafe Pacific has helped turn its Hong Kong home into a premier transport hub, making the airline one of the world's leading aviation brands. Find out how Cathay Pacific is flying into 2015 and get the view beyond the horizon in The Forecast, the brand new magazine from the editors and bureau of Monocle.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Samira Shackle and John Everard. Now, as you should know by now, and if you don't, you're about to find out, on a newsstand near you is the latest publication from Monocle. It's called The Forecast. It's a new annual survey of the year to come. And all this week on Midori House, we'll be delving into its orangish, what colour would we call that? Sort of peaches.
Pale orange.
Pale orange. I'm colourblind, that's why I'm asking for assistance, through its cover, onto the 240 pages inside to dip in and find a couple of stories worth talking about. And today we're going to talk about an interview with Ahmed Aboutaleb, who is the mayor of Rotterdam, a city which Samira has a large Muslim population, a large number of migrants. This is a mayor who's himself a migrant, who's himself Muslim, and yet has managed to appeal to both those that are in favour of migration and those who, since this is the Netherlands, are slightly less enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so he has. Yeah, I think that what's interesting about this is that he sort of speaks from the perspective of someone who migrated to Holland himself with his parents as a teenager from Morocco. And so I think can speak with a sort of confidence that comes from having been in both worlds, having been in the position of a migrant and being someone who is obviously very settled in Holland and has moved up in politics. So I think that that sort of gives the confidence to talk about issues in a certain way where you're not just sort of pandering to left or right. It's also interesting he's not sticking to a particular party line. Mm. And I think that the success of these kinds of politicians really does, it's a sort of living personification of why it's really important to have diversity in politics, because, you know, it's quite often written off as a sort of fluffy issue that people talk about, sort of getting people from different backgrounds into politics. But I think it's really important because you can speak with a different perspective and a certain level of authority if you've got lived experience.
And John, you know, unlike France, where there's been all sorts of problems surrounding the way that, and indeed Italy as well, where politicians from migrant backgrounds have been treated or have been expected to be. It's interesting that in the Netherlands, which does have an issue with, let's face it, with the way the rest of us see how they act on the issue of migration and indeed race. You know, we are coming up to the period of Christmas, and Svart Piet will be making his annual racist appearance. It is interesting that, you know, there is a mayor here who's willing to take on all comers, really, here.
Well, yes, it is. I think this is, you're quite right to draw the distinction between what happens in the Netherlands and what happens, for example, in France. One of the interesting facets of the debate over immigration in the Netherlands is that from an early point, it's focused on a Dutch word which I can hardly pronounce, Einbürgering, I think it is, with the process.
We'll trust your Dutch pronunciation there.
You're kind, thank you. But the process of assimilation, the process of helping immigrants to become Dutch. And I think one of the key aspects of this fascinating story is that the mayor of Rotterdam, coming from that background, has stressed that he believes this, that it is possible to be both Muslim and Dutch without any conflict. It's that the immigrants can be good Dutch citizens at the same time as keeping their own heritage. There's no contradiction in that. And that seems to resonate with Dutch people. His approval ratings are through the ceilings, you know.
Samira, it's very tricky in this country to have these sorts of conversations because they're often led by, frankly, by white people saying, you see, now Muslims need to understand you know, how to be British. Mm. It often seems to come from, you know, from white people to migrants rather than from actual other, you know, migrant politicians or leaders or thinkers discussing things for their own communities.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think there's also an issue that if you look at the three main parties, there's a sort of race to out-tory each other on immigration. You know, you don't really have anyone making a positive case for immigration or a positive case for sort of how to tackle some of those problems. You've just got people pointing out the problems and a sort of race to see who can hammer minorities more. And I think that's quite a dangerous area dangerous direction for the discussion about immigration to be going. When I think there's huge scope to have a positive conversation about it, and to not just have a solely positive conversation, but to have a productive conversation about how you address some of those issues. And I think certainly including non-white voices in that is hugely important. I mean, we've seen quite the opposite, actually. And when you have predominantly white politicians talking about the need for British values, which I think is quite offensive to people who've been here, not just their parents immigrated, but their grandparents did, and so have never really known anywhere else. I think that's the implicit message of that is you're not British and you never will be.
Samira Shackle and John Everard, will leave it right there. That story on Ahmed Aboutaleb is in Directives, which is the first part of The Forecast, the new publication from Monocle, which is out right now. If you don't have a copy, go to your nearest newsagent, or of course you can buy it on our website, monocle.com. You're listening to Midori House. We're back with more after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Coming up in the second half of Midori House, we'll be flicking through the new French news weeklies. We'll also review some of the best new Brazilian music. And we'll also have an interview with the director of the new film Eastern Boys. But first, here's Paul with the headlines.
A US Senate report highlighted what it's called brutal interrogation of terror suspects using techniques that are widely believed to be torture. The CIA is accused of misleading the American people about what it was doing and whether it worked. The techniques included waterboarding and sleep deprivation. President Obama says some of the actions were contrary to US values. The president of Zimbabwe has sacked his deputy. Robert Mugabe accuses Joyce Mujuru of plotting to depose him and possibly even kill him. She denies plotting against the 90-year-old president, whose wife, Grace, had led the campaign against her. Ukraine's government says both sides are largely observing a ceasefire in the east of the country. President Petro Poroshenko says that there should have been a day of silence ahead of planned talks between the government and pro-Russian separatists. And a judge in Spain has ordered the online taxi booking service Uber to halt its operations in the country. The court ruled the firm's drivers were unfair competition with licensed taxi services. That ban was imposed the day after officials in the Indian city of Delhi barred Uber after one of its drivers was accused of raping a passenger. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
...1932 in Paris, 1832 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for us to have a little look at the newest, freshest French news weeklies. Bénédicte Pavillot, London correspondent for France 24, is here to take us through them. Bénédicte, welcome to Midori House. I see you have Paris Match in front of you.
I do indeed.
And it's got, look at him there, Nicolas Sarkozy, looking very lovely with Carla Bruni.
That's right. They're on the cover.
They are on the cover. Now, we know why they're on the cover, because he's trying to make his comeback. What does Paris Match have to say about all that?
Well, I think it's quite telling that we've got the two of them, not just him, on the front, but then that's quite usual for Paris Match, which gives us the softer, really, underbelly of French politics. It's interesting, of course, it underlines the fact that ex-President Sarkozy was very supportive of Carla when he lost his bid to be president a second time, to be re-elected against the current President Hollande. But it does underline the fact that Carla was not keen at all on Nicolas Sarkozy going back for a second bite, if you want, of the cherry, if I may be so bold.
You may.
Thank you for that. And she really preferred him when he was a businessman, earning an awful lot of money, a bit a la Tony Blair, going around the world and heading conferences. She's not at all keen because she was worried before that he is going to have a lot of difficulty. There's going to be a lot of people who are not going to be kind to him, and she's not just referring to the media, but also to people in his own party.
Well, indeed, and also there's a lot of work to be done in becoming a politician again. Not necessarily once he gets to the Elysee. I'm sure there'll be a lot of work there, but there's the glad handing, there's the turning up for a rally in Lille, there's all that sort of stuff that you imagine that Carla Bruni might not be so keen to get involved in.
But she's very supportive, and indeed in his first rallies, she's been there along with his three sons. And so it's this, you know, I support you, you support me couple. Let's remember that President Sarkozy is the one who really created this watershed in French politics, where French presidents traditionally under the Fifth Republic were much more distant. They let their prime ministers get on with things. But Nicolas Sarkozy, was the one who invited the media into their lives, what I would call the helloization or the barimachization, if I can put it into a word. But of course, what President Sarkozy was not at all keen on was he loved the good media and articles that were very pro him, but he was not happy once the media was then looking at other aspects of his life. Anyway, here what Paris Match underlines is that there are great divisions, as we know, in the party that he has once again become the leader of, indeed, that he founded, that it's not going to be an easy road, but Carla will be left also to have her freedom, sa liberté. She will be appearing at the Olympia, famous music hall in Paris in the spring. She's got other music dates, and he will be there supporting her. So there.
And is this very much a sort of a soft focus sort of interview? And the way they've dealt with it has been quite sort of.
It is. It's not. It recognises there are huge financial problems for the party, the UMP party. There are huge internal divisions, and this will be quite difficult. And in fact, it will be much harder than his first time around. But it does emphasise that they're a strong couple. The message is we're supportive of each other. In the same with, he says, he's trying to unite the party.
Okay. One other sort of perhaps more political story. This is about how China is spying on France and indeed the rest of the world. Where's this story to be found?
This is in L'Obs, the magazine that a lot of our listeners will remember. It used to be called Le Nouvel Obs or Le Nouvel Observateur. It is also the cover story. And it says, the cover says, how China spies on us. Us meaning France, us meaning Europe, us meaning Africa, East Africa, West Africa, South America. It's absolutely fascinating. 9 kilometres away from Paris, in the south of Paris, away from their embassy in the middle of the very posh centre of Paris. This their equivalent, the Chinese equivalent of the NSA, called APL3, L'Obs tells us, are busy spying. They've got three huge dishes. It's in a small village and the neighbours weren't aware of this. Apparently the French intelligence services are very much watching this, but not wanting to rock the boat because they don't want to upset commercial contracts.
And how have L'Obs covered this story? So how much space have they given it?
They've given it over 7 pages with analysis, facts, and they say this is exclusive. They're not aware. They call them the big ears of China, and they say that this kind of spying is crucial to China and to China's rise in geopolitics. It also, interestingly, says, unlike France, unlike Britain, unlike America, it doesn't have ex-colonies abroad, which it can put listening stations and posts into. So it has to use, its embassies and its consulates to spy. And of course, they are not only spying, thanks to 2 satellites, Turaya and Inmarsat, on one of those, Turaya 2, has monitors 13,000 communications or transmits 13,000 communications simultaneously. The mind boggles. And so therefore, it's saying that the Chinese can spy on all these businessmen travelling across Africa, whether it be they French, European, American, etc., setting up these contracts.
And then just finally, you wanted to mention a little story about the Eurostar, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary.
Yes, I did indeed, because it's a very important anniversary. anniversary. We've got very used to it. It's as though we were basically taking the tube between the two countries, between whether it's...
And you remember there were times when we used to have to get a ferry. You have to go down to Dover and get a ferry.
Yes, and a train and a ferry, or a hovercraft or a catamaran, etc. And it is... We've become very, very used to this. But it's nothing that we should... Well, we can get used to it, but the figures are absolutely phenomenal. 10 million passengers every year, constant growth. How many, no low cost or even normal airline can talk about that. They're on an increase of 2% per year. People like the Beckhams, Kate Moss, indeed the Queen herself took it.
And yet, despite all this, I must say, no Wi-Fi on most of the trains.
It's coming.
And also, like the lounges at either end, not that good.
Yeah, do you know, you'll be very relieved to hear. I don't think that's true of the London St Pancras one. And the Brussels one, I missed by 24 hours when I was there in September, has just had a huge refit.
Fair enough.
And the Gare du Nord, that a certain Andrew Street of John Lewis, if I mention him briefly, complained about, well, he'll be very relieved, Mr Street, as anybody going to the Gare du Nord Eurostar terminal, to know that actually thousands and thousands of euros are going to be spent on it.
Okay.
So it will be spanking brand new.
Fair
enough. And that's not even mentioning the new Eurostars that are coming in at the end of next year that I've been on, seen in St Pancras, and they are stunning.
Okay, there we are. Benedict Paviot, London correspondent for France 24, thank you very much indeed for taking us through this week's French Weeklies. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, 2041 in Istanbul, 1841 here in London, and 1341 in New York City. The writer of the Cannes Palme d'Or winner, The Class, is back, and this time he's directing. Eastern Boys by Robin Campillo tells of the love story between a young male hustler and his older client. Besides this love story, the film is also a reflection on modern immigration in Europe. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Robin in our studios here in London.
The love story is about someone who is an occidental, sedentary, middle-aged man in Paris and a foreigner and undocumented migrant. And I was more interested by the fact that those two people are trying to build something together. It's something which is very complicated because it starts like a prostitution thing, you know, and their relationship mutates a lot during the film to become something so weird, so different from the start that for me it was a way to show that a person like Daniel can be invaded by this young guy and who can be threatening because of his gang, but this young guy helped him to reinvent his own life, and that's what it's all about. It's all about.
And also there's incredible performances about the main actors. How did you find them? Was it easy to choose? Did you knew those actors before, both the character of Daniel and the Ukrainian as well?
Daniel, yes, I saw him on a different French films. But, you know, it's very interesting because it was not the first role in any film, I think, the first part in any film. It was the first time for him. But I saw him in Des Hommes et des Dieux of Men and Gods, I think, a film by Xavier Beauvoir. and he has a very significant character. And I thought it was like a kind of shy guy, a little bit weak. And I love the way he was behaving. We did some tests together, and he was exactly the kind of guy, you know, you don't know what's going on in his head. And for me, it's very important that the spectators try to think what's going on in his head. So I love this actor. And the two Russians actor, because there's also the character of boss, which is very important to me, which is the boss of the gang. I found them looking at films on internet, you know, because I searched them for 9 months. It took me time because of the difference of the alphabet and everything. So I saw like 100 of Russian films, not very good ones. You can tell when the actors are very good, you know, when you see very bad films and you can, you
see
know,
there's something good
yeah,
in it.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
Tu peux quel jour dans la semaine? Lundi?
Yes, lundi. Comment dire en français?
You told me that actually the apartment that Daniel lives, actually, it's
yeah.
your own,
yeah.
if I can say that. So was it very personal for you, this film, then, somehow?
No, it was personal in my work. You know, I did my first film, which is called Les Revenants, The Returned. I think it's a little bit famous here because there's a TV series was inspired by this film. I was thinking that directing is what it was all about, controlling everything during the shooting, the actors. And I was hoping to do a different film, a film where I'm invaded by the others who are going to explain to me what my film is all about. So I think it was an honest position to do it in my own flat and to get...
Because it was quite literally an invasion.
Yes, it's an invasion, but it's I wanted to show how an invasion, even if it looked a little bit frightening, it's always a chance to reinvent ourselves, and that it's not only something we should be afraid of. It's very important that we reinvent ourselves in front of foreigners, of even undocumented migrants.
Do you prefer to direct or to write for a film? Because I know, of course, you had this collaboration with Laurence Cantet, and so I wonder what's your favorite role?
I hate to write anyway. I think it's boring to write because you're lonely. It's too boring, you know. It's some step you have to do, but you would have liked to find a machine, you know, you put your ideas on the side and at the end you have the script who goes out, you know. I hate to write, but that's the only way I could do a film, you know.
But thankfully you do, otherwise we wouldn't have classic films like The Class, for example.
Yeah. But, you know, The Class, we did it, it was a novel at the beginning of François Bégodeau, the guy who did the teacher. And so... it was a little bit easier, but it's better, you know, when what I'm trying to do is to write not so much, try to find the actors and do improvisations or kind of rehearsal. And after, I try to write it down better. But for me, it's a curse. It's something I would like to avoid, really.
As a personal curiosity, what about writing heading south? Was that your idea?
No, it was the idea of Florent because it's inspired by three short novels from Danny Laferrière, an Haitian writer. So it was his idea because he went a lot of time in Haiti and he wanted to make a film about Haiti.
And after Eastern Boys, Robin, I'm just wondering if you have any new projects in mind, or are you still promoting?
I'm trying to stop promoting, but we have to do it, and it's good, you know, because it's our job in a way. But now I have two projects. I have a project, a fantasy film like my previous film, with much more money, I hope so. I wanted to do it with Catherine Deneuve. She doesn't know yet, but she will. And
if you're listening, Catherine.
Yes, of course. And I have another project about activist group about AIDS in Paris in the early 90s called ACT UP, which is ACT UP Paris. And I wanted to make a film about a group of militants.
That was Robin Campillo, director of the film Eastern Boys, which is out now. You're listening to Midori House. Yeah,
In October, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau moved to the city's Tomigaya area. It's a charming neighbourhood home to a mix of traditional and new businesses. There's a tatami mat maker, soba noodle restaurants, a traditional lute artisan, along with bistros, cafes and design-minded select shops. This week, we take a stroll down the street to meet some of our new neighbours. Today, we head across the street to visit Takai Oedi, the third generation owner of a tatami or reed mat shop, whose family-run business has been here since the end of the Second World War.
My name is Takao Oide. My grandfather started tatami shop Jozo Oide. I'm the third generation in my family to run the business. Before the Second World War, our shop was closer to Shibuya, across the road from where the Tokyu department store is now. But during the war, as the fighting intensified, my father fled to Saitama, a rural area north of here, where my grandfather was originally from. We moved to this location after the war because we own land here.
The business got its start in 1927. Oida-san's father took over around 1950. Oida-san himself is now 54 and began learning to make tatami or reed mats when he was just 18. He now makes and sells tatami, fusuma sliding doors, and shoji paper screens for windows, mainly for homes and restaurants in the neighborhood.
We are seeing a shift from wooden homes to tall modern buildings. Using tatami mats indoors is a tradition in Japan. But because our living environment is changing, the number of rooms made with these mats have been in decline. In the past, there were more tatami rooms than Western-style rooms in homes, but today it's the opposite. In Tokyo, people tend to have a guest room or just one room with tatami mats in their homes.
Oida-san remembers when there were many small retail shops on the street. Recently, quite a few of the longtime shopkeepers have closed, perhaps because they had no one to take over the business. That's brought change to the neighborhood. Restaurants, bars, and select shops, among others.
Around here, we have Teo Broma, a chocolate and cake shop that won in a pastry championship on a TV program. They've been here for a while, and others like them are now coming here. Fulin and Monocle are here too. These are names that are known worldwide. They could have picked any location in Tokyo, but they decided on this location for some reason. To be honest, we locals don't really understand why. That's why we want to ask you. We're grateful that you've come here, but we don't know why you ended up here. That said, we extend a warm welcome to you and we wish you success on the street.
That was Takao Oede, owner of the tatami shop Jozo Oede, one of Monocle Tokyo Bureau neighbours. We're going to end with some music, specifically some new Brazilian music. To talk us through what we're going to listen to is Lewis Robinson, owner of the label Maison Discos. Lewis, welcome to Midori House.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. We've got two new tracks and one newish track. We're going to start with Dona Anete with Carimbo Chamagado.
Yes, Dona Anete. She's 74 years old. This is her debut album.
Debut album, 74. Brilliant.
She wanted to get it right. she's been singing songs. She grew up in this city called Belém do Pará, which is at the mouth of the Amazon in the north of Brazil. She grew up, she was a teacher. Then I think she was a secretary for education in a local state. And she was just writing songs all the time, but she never thought anything would come of them, just writing songs for herself to sing. And then a local group heard her singing at a party, invited her into the studio. She did some songs with them, which led on to her doing a debut album. And then, we've released it this month to great reviews.
Brilliant. Well, why don't I let you introduce it and then we can hear a little bit of it.
So this track is called Carimbo Chamagado.
She sounds good for 74. In fact, she sounds great.
Yeah, she's very lively. And if you, I won't translate her lyrics now because they're quite fruity, should we say.
We can do a little bit of fruitiness.
Yeah, they're quite racy. Okay. It's kind of, you know, young boy, how you doing? Come over and see me. That's the mild fruitiness.
Excellent. Good. I think I'm quite intrigued by Tamisa now. let us know when you want to bring her over. We can have her do a Midori House session here. Okay. Next track. This is by Meta Meta, Hyena Das Cabezas. Tell us a bit about this.
So Meta Meta are, they're a trio, but they kind of, when they play live, they also play as a five piece. People describe them as Afro-punks. Most of their music comes from Candomblé, the Afro-Brazilian religion, but they live in Sao Paulo, so they're very much urbanites, and they kind of mix. And they play it in a sort of punky, jazzy, kind of very contemporary way. But yeah, if you get the chance to see them live, they are an incredible, incredible live band.
Let's hear a little bit of them right now. That was Meta Meta with Hyena Das Cabezas. Both of those tracks are out now. And Lewis, the final track you want to play us today is newish rather than new.
Yeah, this is from a very special project that's been two journalists from Sao Paulo compiled, got some kind of contemporary artists to cover old original Afro-Brazilian songs that were kind of committed to vinyl in, I think it's around the 1940s. The dates differ, but this one is really special. It's the track Batuque, which I think was one of the first Candomblé tracks released on vinyl, 20s, 30s. Features a new singer called Huso Passapuso. Yeah, it's a fantastic song.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of it now. That was Huso Passapuso with Batuque there. So of those three tracks, if you had to pick a favourite?
Oh, God.
It's like choosing between your children.
Yeah,
it?
It's like I've been listening to Meta Meta are on a European tour at the moment. So they played London last Monday. So I'd say Meta Meta just because it's kind of stuck in my head at the moment.
And you've seen them recently.
Yeah, they're kind of.
There we are. Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you very much for that. Lewis Robinson from Mizum Discos. Thank you very much for coming in. And yeah, anytime you want to bring in any of your acts for a Midori House session.
No problem.
Just let us know. That brings us to the end of Midori House. Thank you very much to all our guests, but in particular to John Everard and Samira Shackle. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant and Alia Massoud. The studio manager was Joel Church. Up next, after the headlines with Paul Osborne, is Section D with Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris. And do stay tuned for the Monocle Daily. That's coming up a little bit later, 2200 hours London time, with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Midori House is back again at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, at 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
New York,
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.